According to my next guest, the dangers of recreational drugs have been vastly exaggerated. Dr. Carl Hart is Professor of Psychology at New York's Columbia University. And his new book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups, is both a scientific investigation of drugs and their effects and an impassioned polemic against the racism that he says has fueled the futile war on drugs. Dr. Hart, who has been using heroin regularly for the last 5 years, as well as methamphetamine and cocaine, says he is a better person for it. It's a fascinating book, but it also feels dangerous. Something Dr. Hart is aware of. In fact, his initial work as a researcher was aimed at proving that drug use caused bad outcomes. And now he says he wants to demystify them. Dr. Hart's with me now. Hello, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, it's a pleasure. Tell me about your upbringing, because it's a long way from where you are now.
I think I have to first contextualize my book based on the introduction. I just want people to understand that the first line of the book is, it says that this is not a book promoting drug use. And so people can maybe get a different or warped perspective based on some of the introduction. So I just want to make sure that people understand that I'm not promoting drug use. I'm not saying that drug addiction isn't a real thing. It's, I'm not saying that it's not a problem, because it is. So people understand that.
Yeah, no, I understand that. What we'll come to is a question about whether in your condemnation of the war on drugs and what fuels it, you end up promoting drug use. But we'll just put that on the back burner for a moment while you tell me about your upbringing.
I don't think that's true.
Well,
that's not true.
We can discuss it, but would you please tell me about how you grew up?
I'm a Black American, and I grew up in a Black American neighborhood, like most Black people in the United States.
And your view of, for example, crack cocaine in the 80s was what?
Like most Americans, I thought crack cocaine was the scourge of the earth. I thought that crack cocaine was the reason for problems that we saw in a number of communities, including my own.
And now?
Now I don't have that view. I now understand a lot more than I did then. I understand that the problems that I saw at the time were caused by things like lack of employment, poor education, no health care, lack of opportunity, racial discrimination. A wide range of other factors were more important than crack cocaine, because crack cocaine was only used by a very small segment or a small number of our citizens.
So I understand that you say the damage done to communities should be attributed to poverty and indeed the criminalization of drugs rather than any inherent damage caused by drugs themselves.
That is true. That's right. That's a conclusion that is shared by another number of experts.
Similarly, a number of experts can point to the damage that drugs do to people's physical health.
Sure. Drugs certainly can. Some drugs, alcohol included, tobacco included, some drugs taken over extensive periods of time and people not getting proper nutrition, other health care, sleep. Drugs can certainly have deleterious or negative effects on your physical health and as well as your mental health.
One of the most compelling parts of your book is when you look at the way drug use has in some way been co-opted by the criminal justice system as an indicator of criminality rather than criminality in itself. For example, that's a really complicated way of saying it. Let's just cut to the case of Trayvon Martin, for example, the 17-year-old African-American who was shot by George Zimmerman. The defense lawyers suggested he was aggressive because of cannabis, which was a theory that I suspect was widely bought in the United States among a number of people. What do you say?
One of the things that I point in the book, one of the major points of the book, is to show the reader how drugs are scapegoated for bad behavior perpetrated by the police or other authority figures, police, folks who want to be police. And so in the case of Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman was a neighborhood watch guy, and he said that this is after the effect. This is post hoc. After he had killed Trayvon Martin, he said that Trayvon Martin was high on marijuana, and that's why Trayvon Martin attacked him. But it was clear from the audio tape that Trayvon didn't attack him, but George Zimmerman attacked Trayvon. But George Zimmerman's defense was enough of a smoke screen in order to get him off of that charge. But when you look at Trayvon Martin's toxicology and you see the levels of marijuana in his system, as I did, those levels were placebo levels, meaning that Trayvon Martin probably hadn't smoked for at least 24 to 48 hours before the encounter with George Zimmerman. So again, drugs were used as a scapegoat in order to excuse the murder by George Zimmerman.
System tested for drugs by the prosecution?
Yes, Trayvon Martin's system was tested for drugs, and he had, like I said, a small amount of THC, the active component in marijuana. The amount was so low, it was placebo levels.
Yeah, I was wondering if George Zimmerman had his system tested for drugs.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't hear you. I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
George Zimmerman was not required to have a test for drugs.
I mean, that would have been interesting, although in your terms, not helpful, I suppose.
No, whether someone uses a drug or not, if they misbehave, if they break the law, they are still required to be sanctioned by the law. So whether he had a drug in his system, you can think about someone who is a radio announcer who drank alcohol last night with her significant other. She will have alcohol in her system the following morning, but she can still do her job. So the alcohol in her system is not really that relevant.
No, but you do make me wonder whether if drug use in a responsible fashion, any kind of drug use is fine, you would draw the line on a brain surgeon having a snort of heroin the night before, or would you?
You would draw the line whether it's the night before or a week before if the drug impacts negatively the person's performance. And so it's not about the drug. It's about whether or not the person is able to perform the task. Our focus on the drug misses the point. I'm more concerned about, can that surgeon do her job? I'm more concerned about, can that pilot fly the plane?
I know, but how do we know that the pilot can fly the plane unless we can be assured that we've seen her do it under the influence of various drugs? Do you know what I mean? It's like this, it calls for such a level of individual responsibility that we may as well dispense with all of our systems of reassurance.
Well, I'm suggesting that many of your systems of reassurance is they're false assurances.
Right.
For example, many of your pilots already have amphetamines in their system when they're flying the plane. And so I think in your country, methamphetamine is a concern. Your pilots, our pilots in the military and those sorts of things, they have amphetamines in their system because amphetamines help to keep them alert and awake and that sort of thing. And but by that same token, those drugs are vilified when they're used illicitly. And so I am pointing out that we should really shore up our behavioral measures to make sure the person is capable of accomplishing the task at hand. So even if that means that they have to take a test before getting in the cockpit, for example, fine. I don't think we have that sort of thing at the moment.
Throughout modern history anyway, there has always been a panic about a certain drug. I mean, in my memory, reefer madness. And then there was heroin. And now there's the opioid epidemic that we've heard a lot about in the United States. Is all of this driven by empty moral panic? Or is there any substance to it?
There always is some sort of real reason for the panic. But oftentimes the panic is exaggerated. For example, as you point out, in the country, in our country, we've had a number of people die from a drug-related overdose. And so that's a very real thing. The problem is that we are failing to get at what's the cause and precisely what's happening. And so the panic prevents us from dissecting the cause and coming up with solutions. That's what I'm suggesting.
So drug-related overdoses, you would attribute to the vulnerable state of the individual and the dangerous state of the drug as a consequence of its illegality?
That's certainly in line. You're absolutely right. I would just state it a little differently. In the United States, most of the people who die from a drug-related overdose death, they have multiple drugs in their system, five, six drugs in their system. When you combine specific drugs, say like you combine an opioid, something like heroin, with something like alcohol or benzodiazepine or an antihistamine, it increases the likelihood of the individual having respiratory depression. And so the public education message should be, if you're going to use an opioid, for example, do not combine it with another sedative, especially if you are a novice. That would help save a lot of people. And another reason that people are dying is because they are getting tainted drugs. Their drugs are tainted with some adulterant that's even more dangerous than the drug that they're seeking. We can think about fentanyl and fentanyl analogs. People may be trying to get heroin when in fact they have fentanyl, and then they take a certain amount that they usually take for heroin, but turns out if you take that same amount for fentanyl, it becomes deadly. And so I would suggest that I have argued that we need to have these facilities where people can have their drugs tested for a chemical analysis. And if it contains a contaminant that is dangerous, then they won't take it. But we have not implemented these drug checking facilities. So those are two sort of simple solutions to deal with the very real problem of people dying from drug-related deaths.
Of course, you raise the issue of alcohol. Alcohol is a legal drug. It causes a great deal of damage. People overindulge. They kill themselves. They drive while drunk and kill other people. They cause mayhem and domestic violence, all the rest of it. We know all this. This, despite the fact that people are urged to drink responsibly and constantly warned that alcohol can be dangerous, and it is regulated in terms of quality. Does this not undermine your argument?
Oh no, I mean, I absolutely agree with you. You're absolutely right in that we have alcohol and we see the problems, as you nicely point out, that can happen as a result of alcohol use. You're right. And so we try to do our best in terms of controlling the amount that can be placed in a certain in a container. We call that the unit dose. We have restrictions on age, and we try to do a better job of education so people know under what conditions and how negative effects may occur. So we do our best, but we don't ban alcohol because a few people, a relatively few people, are having problems with alcohol. We don't ban it. Instead, we try to enhance the safety, and we try to address those issues that people are having. And so I think that the people should be fully aware that life is not without risk. In the United States, every year, 40,000 Americans lose their life because of car accidents. But we're not going to ban cars. What we try to do is enhance the safety of that activity. We require people to wear seat belts. We have speed limits. We require people to pass a test before getting behind the wheel of a car. All of these things are done in order to try to enhance the safety of that activity, but we don't ban the activity.
Could we just, let's just stay on the alcohol issue for a moment. Could you not similarly argue that despite all our legalization and regulation of alcohol and our warnings surrounding it, it causes so much damage? Are you saying that if drugs were similarly regulated, they would cause less damage than they do now? And if so, why?
Yeah, thank you. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying by forcing drug users off into the shadows, you have this billion, multi-billion dollar industry, the illicit drug trade. You have it in the hands of people who don't necessarily care about your health, and there's no quality control when it comes to these substances. So, in our country, tens of thousands of Americans lose their life because of these adulterants in some case, in many cases. Others are forced off into the shadows, and they have the ones who inject, they may have dirty equipment. Others are taken to prison. We have 2.3 million Americans behind bars. A large percentage are there because of drug law, violation of drug laws. Lives are ruined by our current approach. If we legally regulated these things, you now can educate people. You can have bring people out of the shadows. People who need help, it would be less stigmatized. So I am suggesting that the risk of our current approach are too great, and the benefits would be enhanced if we re legally regulated and had some quality control, and we decreased the stigma, and people would, I think, be safer.
We've heard much, as I mentioned, of the opioid epidemic in the United States. Are you saying that that's overstated?
I'm saying that it's misunderstood. We can think about the numbers for a second. I think this year or the last year, we said that there were about 80,000 Americans. That's 80,000 Americans who lost their life due to overdoses. And then when you look at the opioids, it's about 45,000, I believe, in that were that that opioids were involved. What that means is that at the time of the person's death, they had an opioid in their system. 45,000 Americans had an opioid in their system. The way that it's reported is that opioids caused 45,000 Americans to lose their life. And that's not necessarily true. In fact, we don't know what was the cause of their death because people have multiple drugs in their system. And so we don't tease that apart, one. And in some cases, we don't even know what was in their system. And so it prevents us from educating people properly in order to make sure we avoid this from happening again. That's what I'm saying.
I don't know whether you have any view on this, but the implications of what you just said surely are that the lawsuits against Purdy Pharmaceuticals or the Cirque family are not going to succeed or are illegitimate.
No, I think that some of the lawsuits have succeeded. Well, the pharmaceutical companies have settled out of court because it, in large part, bad publicity. But one of the things that the pharmaceutical companies are guilty of, and that this is on record, at least one of the companies downplayed the addictive potential of an oxycodone a drug that they marketed. They said that its addictive potential was less than other opioids. Turns out that wasn't true. And so they had to pay a big fine for misleading the public. So in those kind of cases, the pharmaceutical companies are certainly responsible for misleading the public.
I'm talking to Dr. Carl Hart about his book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups. In New Zealand, our current concern is a pee epidemic, as you said, meth. It's linked with violence. We're very worried about it. We have stories saying that, you know, entire towns it's easier to get than marijuana, and it's causing mayhem and violence and death. What's your take on that?
You know, it's hard for me to speak directly to what's happening in your country about meth, but I can talk about the effects of methamphetamine. The effects of methamphetamine is that it's a drug that's used in the United States or approved in the United States to treat attention deficit disorder as well as obesity. And other amphetamines are used too for that purpose, but they are also used to treat narcolepsy. So the drug is used really to keep people awake when they need some energy. Our military, some members of our military services, they take amphetamines. Methamphetamine and amphetamine are essentially the same drug. Now, if a drug is taken constantly, a drug like amphetamines are taken constantly such that it's disrupting people's sleep. They're not sleeping, and it also decreases their food intake. They're not eating properly. Both of those things can lead to some psychological difficulties. People can have some psychological problems like paranoia, anxiety, they certainly can be irritable because they're not getting sleep. And then they're not getting proper nutrition, which also can contribute to poor psychological health. So if people are taking the drug on a frequent basis and long-term or chronic basis, yeah, certainly they can have some negative effects, these negative effects, and they might misbehave. But I assure you, the vast majority of people who use amphetamines are not engaging in that type of behavior. In fact, we administered these drugs to kids as young as 6 years old. I'm not endorsing that. I'm just saying what the reality is. And we don't see those kind of problems.
No. I mean, I completely understand that you're sanctioning drug use by responsible adults only, right?
You mean in the book?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, yes.
And what would a responsible person be? I mean, how do we need to define that?
Yes, in the book, I define it. And you know, my definition is not static. You know, being a responsible adult isn't something that you achieve and then it's all over. It's a difficult thing. You know, these people, of course, they meet their occupational, social, and family obligations. They look after themselves. They eat well. They sleep well. They exercise. They contribute to their community. All of these sort of things that we want to encourage people in our society to do. And it's a difficult thing. It's difficult to be a grown-up every day. And so I that's the definition I go with in the book. But I recognize that it's not something that it's easily achieved.
Because the individuals who feel compelled to use any kind of drugs in excess, whether it be legal or illegal, are those least able to handle them. That's the tricky bit, isn't it?
The ones that are who are less likely to handle that are the ones that are more likely to use. I'm sorry, is that what you said?
The people who are more likely to use drugs in excess are those least able to handle them, least able to know when they've had enough, delayed gratification, need to put the kids to bed, whatever it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know if I can agree with that. I don't. I think that the vast majority of people who use substances are those people who are meeting their obligations.
But
But of
why do you
course,
say that?
I'm sorry.
Why do you say that?
Because when we look at survey data around our country, for example, we have more than 35 million Americans who use an illegal substance in the past year. We have that's a large number of people, and these people have homes, jobs. There are people who certainly have problems, as you described. I mean, that certainly we see those people. In fact, we see those people overrepresented in our media, in our movies, documentary films. Because it's drama and it's sexy. Whereas if you have people who are meeting their obligations and they're also having to use pee on the weekend or something, there's no story there. That's kind of boring. Nobody wants to report about that sort of thing. And so that's part of the reason I wrote the book to show how we have this disproportionate presentation of negative drug effects in our media. In large part because it sells, it's sexy, and sex sells.
One thing that it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that most scientists have been fairly certain of is the risk of marijuana causing psychosis or schizophrenia in young users. What's your view of that?
First of all, we don't recommend that young people use marijuana or any psychoactive substance. So let's just put that out there.
Well,
But in
how
terms
young?
of that, I'm sorry, I'm talking about people who are not adults.
Yes.
So when we think about the data, the actual data showing that marijuana causing young people to have a psychosis or a psychotic disorder. There are some associations, but the cause, that's yet to be determined. I can't state that based on my view of the evidence, but I would not recommend that young people engage in taking marijuana. So I just want to say that because the drug certainly in let's say infrequent users or inexperienced users, certainly at large doses can increase anxiety and anxiety to the point of paranoia. And so that's not one of these things that I would want to recommend to anyone.
Just checking, how young is too young in your view?
I don't know. In the book is called Drug Use for Grown-Ups, and
Yeah.
so I did not want to deal with adolescents. I'm a parent myself, and so I can tell you what I do as a parent, but I don't deal with adolescents or young people who are not adults in the current book.
Okay, tell me what you do with your children.
So my youngest now is 20 years old, and the thing that my wife and I have done is that we, throughout their life, we've encouraged them to meet goals that we thought were important, like them being good citizens, contributing to their community, them being good people, them being educated. We reinforce the goal of them being worldly, so they've had to travel and see how other people live. All of those things are far more important than whether or not they use drugs, but they had to do well in school. And so if anything, whether it's drugs, whether it's having a significant other, whether it's playing video games, if any of those other things interfered with the goals that we set out, then those other sort of activities would have to be stopped, whether it's them taking drugs or whether it's them playing a video game. So as a parent, we focus on the behaviors that are most important. Them doing well in school, them being good citizens, good people, them making contributions to their community. All of those things are, those are the goals that we focus on.
I mean, I don't want to breach the confidentiality of your children, but did you have to stop them taking drugs at any point because they were interfering?
No. One of my kids graduated, the one who's older, he's graduated from an Ivy League institution, and the other one is enrolled in an Ivy League institution. So, and they are good people. They volunteer in their communities. They've done everything that their parents asked of them.
Can you, would I, could I describe you as a libertarian?
A lot of people have tried to do that, but
Yes.
no, that's a great sort of analysis you come up with, but no, I don't like to be described as such, and simply because I try to take whatever approach works. Sometimes it may look libertarian, other times it may look like a Democrat, other time it may look like a Republican. Well, less so a Republican in many cases, but I try to take whatever approach works. And so I try not to be put into a camp because it's like you're on a team and then you have to always support that team, even when that team does something stupid.
The reason I ask is that you very clearly define drugs as a civil liberty issue. And as I understand it, you also defend the right to bear arms, as in the Constitution, which leads me to think that maybe you're on the libertarian end of the spectrum.
That's like I said, I understand how you got there. But please understand that the founding document of our country, the Declaration of Independence, says that each of our citizens are guaranteed at least three birthrights: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so the ideals that I espouse, they emanate from the Declaration of Independence. And so this is what it's supposed to be mean to be an American. It's supposed to mean that we can behave or live as we see fit, as long as we don't disrupt anybody else's ability from doing the same. And so I think of that as being quintessentially American, not libertarian. Unfortunately, it seems like the ideals have been associated only with the libertarians, which is, I think that is troubling. So I understand how you arrived at your conclusion, but I don't like to think of myself as a libertarian. I like to think of myself as an American.
But if the right to bear arms is adhered to as it is that not arguably responsible for the shocking gun death toll in the United States?
Oh my God, that's a great question. Great question. So my support of the right to bear arms is in the spirit in which the law was originally formulated. We were concerned about an overbearing government taking advantage of the people. And so, if you know, and which you do, because you've demonstrated, you know quite a bit about this country. One of the problems that we have is police brutality, particularly against Black Americans. And so my right to bear arms is largely motivated by the state taking advantage of people who look like me. If that did not exist, I would be more likely to be not in favor of the right to bear arms.
So the right to bear arms we're talking about in the spirit in which it was written is the right to happiness, also not interpretable in terms of the spirit in which it was written, which did not include, I don't know, heroin use,
Yes.
presumably.
No, it didn't have to because the founding father, the guy who wrote that, he was a big opioid user, so that was a given. They were all they all used substances.
Well, I mean, this is going off piste, but we have time. You quote Thomas Jefferson, of course, as saying, "Those who allow the government to tell them what to do, they allow their minds are under tyranny." Right?
That allow the government to tell them what they can put in their bodies, right?
All right, but what is that? Where are you on COVID vaccination?
On COVID vaccination, I'm looking forward to getting my vaccination. I'm sorry. I don't. So I am going to be vaccinated. So
No, that's
what?
fine. The question is,
Okay.
there are a lot of people who say the government has no right to tell me, a la Thomas Jefferson, the government has no right to tell me what to do with my body. I'm not taking the vaccination.
Oh, great point. Great point. I see what you're saying. That's a great point. So when my liberty negatively impacts the liberty of others, then my liberty does not supersede the liberty of everyone else. And so if I may be infected and then infect someone else, that's not right. And so that's why I will get vaccinated. So I don't prevent any other people from enjoying their liberty.
Thank you. Here's a question from lots and lots of questions, as you can imagine from the listeners, but here's quite a simple one. Why does a person like Carl Hart need to take drugs? There are a number of ways you could answer that. Give me one.
As in the book, I point out, I don't need to take drugs. In fact, we're all in a pandemic, so you can't really take illegal drugs unless you put yourself in great risk. So we've been in a pandemic for years, so I don't need to take drugs. It's like saying, why do you need to take a car when you have feet and you can walk? It's more enjoyable. It enhances the travel. But there's no need to take drugs.
And so, why do you take drugs?
Why do people take alcohol? That's a drug to enhance social situations, to be euphoric, to be more magnanimous, for the same reasons that we take alcohol.
At what point does an individual become an addict? Is that a pertinent issue?
Yes, that's one of the first issues I deal with in the book. Well, when I talk about addiction, I'm really dealing with the definition laid out in Classifications of Disorder 10 or in the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. That definition basically says that the individual has failed or is failing to meet major obligations in their life as a result of their drug use. Obligations like work, school, family obligations, and the individual is distressed by not meeting these obligations. And there are a list of symptoms that people must endorse before they can be labeled an addict. So that's what I mean when I say addiction. And addiction is a very real thing. And there are ways to deal with it. And I've spent 30 years trying to figure that out.
But you do not think the phrase high-functioning addict is useful?
No, I think it's oftentimes used in this oxymoronic way, because addiction by definition means that you have disruptions in your psychosocial functioning. You're not meeting these obligations. So for somebody to be a functional addict, that just doesn't, it's inconsistent with addiction. Addiction means that you have disruptions. You are not meeting your obligations, your responsibilities.
You were skeptical of the portrayal of heroin, opioid withdrawal in social media and popular media. And so you did your own experiment. Can you tell me about that, please?
I knew that opioid withdrawal was not life-threatening. And so I just did a self-experiment where I put myself through opioid withdrawal after several weeks of taking opioids and then abruptly discontinuing. I wanted to see what it was like. It was, as I expected, unpleasant. I don't have any interest in doing that again, but it wasn't life-threatening. So I described this in the book.
What you describe in the book is that you experienced dreadful pain. But there you are with a comfy bed and a comforting spouse. Another person might simply seek out more drugs to stop the pain rather than gritting their teeth and making the best of it.
This is true. This happens every day in throughout the world, and there are people that do exactly what you describe. I agree. So what we should do is make sure other people have a comfy bed, make sure that they have a roof over their head, and that's what I argue for. Yeah, I've been arguing for that for my career. Absolutely.
Yeah, but if you're going to make the world a happy, pleasant place for everybody before we can safely use drugs, then, you know, it's a long way from legalization of drugs, right? In other words, it's a risky proposition to make drugs very widely available when so many people are not in a position of having a comfy bed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And please understand that I don't have the answers to all of the world's problems, particularly as it relates to poverty and what the world should do. And that's not what I'm trying to do. What I am saying is that our current approach to handling drugs has been far more harmful to a greater number of people than if we would legally regulate drugs. It's a simple argument.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
I do understand that argument. And I'm wondering, if it's that simple, why do you think there's such opposition to it?
Yeah, great question. I can speak for the United States, and in the United States, we have exported our drug policy abroad. So I'll try and say what that means abroad. In the United States, there is a select group of people who are benefiting handsomely from our current approach, our war on drugs. Law enforcement officials are benefiting. Their budgets are increased. Law enforcement jobs are one of the few industries that people can get employment. The prison industry is benefiting. Hotels and restaurants that surround the prisons in the United States benefit because they're out in the middle of nowhere, and loved ones of the prisoners have to frequent the hotels and the restaurants. They are benefiting. People who do urine testing to see if people have drugs, that business is booming. Politicians benefit because they don't have to address issues of poverty, unemployment. They don't have to address any of those issues. All they have to say is we're going to put more cops on the street and get the drugs out of your community. And they look like heroes. They're benefiting. The medical establishment benefits. They control these substances. And when you have a problem, you have to go to them. And so there are the media benefits because it's sexy to talk about cartels, the war on drugs. And it's a sexy thing. Movie producers and movie makers, they benefit. But the people themselves, we don't benefit. And in terms of what's happened around the world, the U.S. exports its awful drug policy, and it ties its awful drug policies in some countries to aid and to make sure that those other countries have a similar misguided approach. And so I think that's why it continues, because there is a select group that are benefiting handsomely.
You, I should say, I'm talking to Dr. Carl Hart, Professor of Psychology at New York's Columbia University. You said that middle-class users have stayed in the closet for too long. How hard was it for you to come out of the closet in terms of your use of methamphetamines and heroin?
It was like, for example, in the United States, some drug use, like psychedelics, it's considered kind of chic, in vogue, it's okay. But then when you say you use other drugs, something like methamphetamine, you are considered evil, wicked. And so it's harder to be out of the closet about that kind of drug use than it is, say, psilocybin or ayahuasca. I did it with some trepidation. I was worried how people would judge me, not based on how I behave as a human, not based on what I have accomplished as a professional, but on what I put in my body. So yeah, I was concerned about it. And so it was, it wasn't the easiest thing I did. This has been a very instructive exercise, because I now have confirmation of what I always knew, that people will dismiss you and judge you just based on what they heard that you might have put in your body.
And your employers, have they pushed back?
No, there is no reason for them to push back.
No. You may say there's no reason for them to push back, but they may see a reason to push back. So have they pushed back?
I said, no, there is no reason for them to push back.
Yeah, but what you see as no reason is not what other people see as a reason, because that's why you've written the book, to try to persuade people to destigmatize the use of drugs.
Yes, but I haven't received any pushback, and I'm asking you, for what reason would someone push back? Did I mistreat someone? Did I not meet an obligation? What did I do for people to push back?
You presumably did nothing except admit to taking hard drugs, which is sufficient for people to push back. Otherwise, you wouldn't have written the book. Psychedelic Renaissance is a very interesting thing. You mentioned that some drugs are lower class drugs and only taken by losers, but psychedelics and psilocybin, they have been taken up by the middle class, microdoses and so on. It's interesting, eh? It's very much, what is it? It's classist.
Yeah, that's right. It's classes, it's elitism, it's paternalism, it's all of those things. And again, that's another one of those things I was trying to highlight.
And I think you said something interesting. You said it's all right if you're looking for spiritual enlightenment, but if you want to just get high, that's not okay.
That's not okay. No, you can't, because you have to have the right verbal behavior if you are taking this a substance.
I read that you are moving to Switzerland. Is this correct?
Yes, this is correct.
What has Switzerland got to offer you?
Peace, quietness, anonymity.
Skiing.
Boring. It's nice and boring and quiet.
But more to the point, it's drug policies.
This is true. The Swiss are not arresting large numbers of their citizens because of what they choose to take as a substance, and they also are they care about their citizens at some basic level. They make sure that people have housing, income that is a livable income, and so I like the fact that. I like it when countries take care of their citizens.
And what does Switzerland do for the people who can't cope with the drugs or become unfunctioning addicts?
I can explain with heroin. I'll just take because that's one of the drugs that people fear most. The people who are having a really hard time with heroin and they have failed in other sort of treatments. They have a program in which they actually provide heroin to these people twice a day, every day. And they also make sure these people have a psychologist, a psychiatrist, an internist, a sort of a physician for general purposes, a social worker, a nurse. All of these individuals are on their treatment team. And so they're looking after the people's happiness and life and health. And so that program has been going on for more than 20 years, and it's successful. And I have a lot of respect for the Swiss in that regard.
Have you got a job in Switzerland?
I have an academic appointment but I will stay in New York too. I will live between New York and Switzerland. It's just that. This is part of my desire to be a better global citizen, and I need to see how other people view the world and see how other people are experiencing the world so I can be more empathetic and a better person as a result, and not be sort of ethnocentric or nationalistic.
The fact that you'll be flying to Switzerland on a regular basis doesn't necessarily make you a better global citizen, but climate change is not our subject for the morning. Look, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you, Dr. Carl Hart, whose book is called Ruggies for Grown-Ups: Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear.